Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than half of those who are incarcerated in American jails and prisons suffer from mental illness. That's according to a 2006 survey by the United States Department of Justice. A more recent study of the Franklin County Jail reveals that people who are mentally ill wind up there more often and stay for longer periods. Now, Franklin County officials, armed with recommendations from the Council of State Governments, are preparing to change that dynamic. Later today, the Board of County Commissioners will vote on a resolution to support the Stepping Up initiative. It's the product of the National Association of Counties, the Council of State Governments Justice Center, and the American Psychiatric Foundation. Joining us now by phone is the Director of Health Systems and Services Policy at the Council of State Governments Justice Center, Dr. Fred Osher. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Is Franklin County unusual in the pattern of stays and recidivism by inmates who are mentally ill?
No, this is a phenomenon that exists throughout the county, out the country, and that 3,069 counties that are out there struggle with the overrepresentation of people with mental illness who are there at rates 3 to 6 times higher than the general population, and that it is a phenomenon that is a product of a number of factors, but recently, has caught the attention of leaders throughout the country and an effort to say the status quo is just not acceptable.
Has it always been this way?
Well, there were, in our history of care for folks with mental illness in our country, efforts to provide them safe environments to live in. We had state hospitals in this country during the 1960s, which had about 550,000 individuals. During the process of deinstitutionalization, there are less than 50,000 individuals in those settings at this point in time. And that without access to housing and the care that they need, all too frequently they wind up in our jails.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the recidivism rates and the periods of stays in the Franklin County Jail for inmates who are mentally ill in Franklin County. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Fred Osher. He's a psychiatrist and director of Health Systems and Services Policy at the Council of State Governments Justice Center. They just prepared a report on the Franklin County system for the county commissioners. How is Franklin County currently prepared to treat mentally ill inmates? Is it pretty typical, or how does it rate?
Well, it is typical, yet it has a history of innovation, and there are many bright lights within the county, a very extensive effort to train law enforcement officers to respond to calls that might involve an individual with mental illness in ways that can de-escalate the crisis, and when arrest isn't necessary, divert to alternatives to incarceration. It is the case that we don't have enough alternatives at this point in time, and that's not different than other counties, but a fact. When that law enforcement officer wants to provide an alternative to incarceration, but the settings are full, not accepting any more individuals, then booking becomes the alternative, and then that starts a process for that individual of arraignment, stay within jail, and as you had highlighted in your introduction, individuals with mental illness come back much more regularly than those without. In our study, it was 60% of those with serious mental illness in the Franklin County Jail returned within 3 years.
So it's not that, all things being equal, law enforcement officers at the front line don't recognize what they're doing. It's that they don't have alternatives.
That's the case, and that certainly increased training for officers, so higher percentages of them are aware of signs and symptoms of mental illness, and the ways in which one can de-escalate on the scene is an important component of our recommendations, but they go beyond that, thinking about ways in which we identify individuals once they come into the jail, provide them the care that they need when they're there, and most importantly, link them to community services upon release so that they can return to community and not return to custody.
So the issues of housing and crisis intervention training by police officers have been brought up already, and we'll be hearing from Michael Woody. He's president of CIT International, and also Michelle Heritage, executive director of the Community Shelter Board here, and coming up, Terry Russell from the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. How you said it's caught the attention, this issue has caught the attention of officials across the country. I assume you're doing other studies for other counties, other political subdivisions across the country?
Yes, and one of the real exciting initiatives that has started is in conjunction with the National Association of Counties and the American Psychiatric Foundation and our own Council of State Governments Justice Center. We started a stepping up initiative in which we're calling on all counties to come forward and develop the responses that might drive the prevalence rates of mental illness down within their jail. Absolutely take the numbers of people that have mental illness and don't pose a public safety risk out of the jail, connect them to treatment, and thereby reducing the huge expenditures that are associated with our arrest and confinement, and more appropriately taking those dollars and investing them in treatment and alternatives that support the recovery. The Stepping Up initiative is something that was launched a couple of weeks ago with calls to action in Washington, D.C., Miami, Florida, Johnson County, Kansas, Sacramento, California, and we're really calling on all counties to be a part of this effort to address what has been a tragedy on our landscape for far too long.
Your report says that Franklin County doesn't collect enough information on risks and needs in a systematic way. Why is that important?
Well, rest is actually a public health opportunity. Many individuals with mental illnesses may not have sought care, either by voluntarily not choosing to do so, not being aware that they had a mental illness, or not being able to afford that care. And when they come into a jail, there is a requirement that they be screened and assessed for all health conditions, mm-hmm. including mental illness and substance use disorders. So doing that in a systematic way and identifying that individual and then beginning the treatment and beginning a plan that would link them to care is an important component of addressing this overrepresentation that we've been discussing.
As you mentioned earlier, one of the recommendations in the report talks about law enforcement's response to people who are mentally ill. Are you talking about at every stage of contact, or are there some stages that are more relevant or more important than others, say, at the time of first contact?
Yes. We believe that if you can divert an individual that doesn't require incarceration, that has a ripple effect throughout the system. They no longer have to spend time in jail. They no longer have to be a part of the court processing, which has enormous costs associated with it, and that they obviously then aren't going to penetrate deeper into the criminal justice system. But there are those individuals that do come forward, and that we want to make sure that we build upon the specialty courts, mental health courts, drug courts that have been a part of the county system for a while to provide alternatives, again, to incarceration and provide the supervision and treatment that those individuals need. There will be inevitably, individuals that are convicted of their crime and in sentence status within the jail, but they all are coming out. And we want to make sure that when they come out, they are linked appropriately to the care in the community that will reduce the revolving door that we're seeing so highly prevalent within Franklin County and so many counties across the country.
I get what the report means when you say that there's the higher recidivism rate among people who are mentally ill. They return to prison or jail more often because they're not being treated properly when they're released. They're not getting the services they needed. But why are their stays longer in the jail?
Findings that those individuals, both in pretrial and sentence status, stay longer, up to two times longer for similar charges. And there's a variety of factors that contribute to that. One, there is a myth that exists that people with mental illness are violent, and we know that in our country that most violence is not committed by people with mental illness, and most people with mental illness don't commit violence, but there's a perception of dangerousness that may not be appropriate. There's the case that bonds get set at rates that people with mental illness who aren't able to afford end up not being able to pay, and they stay there longer as well. There are a variety of procedural issues get raised, and without alternatives in the community, people are reluctant to send folks back to the street where they become a part of the home of settings. And one of our findings, of course, were those individuals with mental illness and without adequate shelter in Franklin County come back far more regularly than those with mental illness that do have a place to stay.
I know you're working a lot with local governments, including the Franklin County Board of Commissioners, but at the state level in Ohio, there's a budget moving through the process that will be approved or not by the end of June. And in the process of this, $6 million has been cut from the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections for the treatment of people who are mentally ill in the prison system. Do you have a sense that the state, at the state level, that officials are as aware as they're becoming at the local level?
There is terrific state leadership within Ohio, both within behavioral health and Department of Corrections, that have been leaders nationally, actually, in identifying the needs of this population and thinking about methods and ways to actually assist when they come out and assure that they don't go back. I think it's important to recognize that the state has chosen to expand Medicaid for individuals that are below the federal poverty level, which opens up access to care for millions of individuals that heretofore have not had access to it. I know that there is active effort between Medicaid and the Department of Corrections to identify people prior to leaving the prison system that may be eligible for insurance and those benefits, identifying, enrolling, and then linking them to care going forward. But I think the trend to decrease funding, is one that we want to ensure doesn't differentially impact the population that we're talking about. And these are public safety as well as public health issues that we're talking about. We want to ensure that individuals get the type of treatment they need so that they can make better decisions and not commit new crimes going forward.
You talked about an inadequate number of diversion programs for people who are arrested or taken off the streets. The only alternative often that police officers have is to put them in jail. Besides just diversion programs, when they're released, there often isn't even a place for them to live. What about the homelessness issue?
Well, nationally and within Franklin County, individuals that don't have adequate shelter and are homeless are very visible within our community. They are frequently arrested for misdemeanor offenses related to their conditions on the street. When one is homeless, the priorities shift dramatically to finding food and shelter, and the access to health care, mental health care, may not be as acute and immediately recognized by that individual. So being homeless is a complicating factor, and not having a place to stay, being on the streets really makes life difficult, and that includes frequent contact with law enforcement.
Dr. Fred Osher, I want to thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. And I would like listeners to know that there is a website, www.stepuptogether.org, if individuals in your community want to be a part of the Stepping Up initiative and help in our responses to the conditions that people face. We'd appreciate their involvement.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You bet. We'll put a link to that website on our website at wosu.org/allsides. We just heard from Dr. Fred Osher. He's Director of Health Systems and Services Policy at the Council of State Governments Justice Center. They prepared a recent study of the Franklin County criminal justice system that found that people who are mentally ill are jailed more frequently and for longer periods of time. We'll talk more about that. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A recent study of the Franklin County criminal justice system by the Council of State Government's Justice Center found that people who are mentally ill are jailed more frequently and for longer periods. And when they are released, they often end up homeless on the streets. Later today, the Board of County Commissioners, in an effort to change that dynamic, will vote on a resolution to support the Stepping Up initiative. If you want to learn more about that, you can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. It's the product of the National Association of Counties, the Council of State Governments Justice Center, and the American Psychiatric Foundation. Joining us now is the Executive Director of the Community Shelter Board, Michelle Heritage. Welcome back, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Also, the Executive Director for the Ohio Chapter of the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, Terry Russell. Welcome back, Terry.
Thank you, Ann.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. In particular, we'd like to hear from people who have been incarcerated in the Franklin County Jail who do have mental health care problems, mental illness problems, and can speak to the homelessness issue and the issue in general. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The connection between mental illness and homelessness is not new, Michelle Heritage, and the relationship with incarceration for both isn't either. So we've been talking about critical CIT, mm-hmm. which is the response by police. What about shelters like the ones that you manage?
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right. We've got a strong connection between folks that are experiencing homelessness and folks that have some mental health challenges or substance use challenges. In our shelters, about half the people we serve are identifying they have some sort of a mental health challenge or substance use challenge. And we know that about 20 to 25% of the folks we're serving are disabled by those kinds of conditions. And so nothing new about that. In fact, there are some in the homeless system across the country who suspect that the deinstitutionalization of folks back in the 80s is part of really the growing trend among homelessness growing across the country. We were supposed to deinstitutionalize people, which was the right thing to do, but we were also then supposed to put together a comprehensive, effective, efficient behavioral health system to provide the services folks needed. It's best to have community-based services, but unfortunately what happened is we didn't put that safety net in, and you see this increase in homelessness. We do see folks that come in. They have very significant needs. One of the things that has happened recently is our Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board has beefed up one of the teams that serve homelessness and put together two new teams specifically for folks coming into our shelters that are not either currently linked or may have had repeated episodes of homelessness and inpatient treatment. But what we were finding is for folks coming, for example, out of inpatient mental health settings, only about half of them were ever linking with a behavioral health provider if they ended up coming into shelter.
Why is that? What's the breakdown, Terry Russell, whether they're coming from a treatment center or from the jail? Why aren't they being better prepared for what's going to happen on the outside?
Well, I think that we have a system, a mental health system in this country that was established over 50 years ago. And then in 1988, we passed the Mental Health Act, which closed hospitals with many promises of a community support system. And those promises just never were fulfilled.
They closed the hospitals before the promises were kept.
Absolutely. And didn't develop the kinds of services. And in fact, today, Franklin County is one of our better systems in Ohio, but the report shows the lack of things such as housing and making sure people know that there's a system available. We used the motto when we went to the legislature last year, you don't get better if you don't have a roof over your head, food in your belly, and somebody knows your name. And as much counseling as you receive, you can go in and see psychiatrist six times a week. But when you walk out, if you don't have a place to live, or you don't know where you're going to eat next, or nobody cares, you're not going to get better. So what I think this report says is we need to look at a continuum of housing options. Some people can live very well independently. Some need some supportive housing. Others need 24-hour support. There were people in state hospitals that needed that kind of care. But it was good public policy, just poor, poor execution of implementation.
So, Michelle Heritage, when you have, you said 20 to 25% of the people that you serve are either have a mental illness problem or a similar problem with the substance mm-hmm. abuse, right? So what happens when you have that situation? What do you do?
What we have developed in our community, and again, Columbus is a national model in terms of how we are ending homelessness in our community, but we still have a long way to go. And so one of the most important things we need to do, I couldn't agree more with Terry, he's right on target with, you cannot think about some of the other challenges in your life if you don't have something as basic as a place to live.
No one can under the best of circumstances, right?
We all learned it in Psych 101. It's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And guess what? That's correct. Which is, if I don't know where I'm sleeping, if I don't know what I'm going to eat, I cannot talk to you about some of the other things that are challenging. We have a housing first model, which means housing has to be first. You don't get somebody off of drugs and alcohol or into treatment first. You do those things at the same time because that housing provides stability. And Franklin County is well ahead. Our mental health board recognizes, and the state of Ohio is really beginning to recognize more and more, that housing is a key component of treatment and recovery. And without housing, we see what happens. This report is clear. Folks will continue to come into shelter. They will continue to cycle into jail. They also cycle into inpatient mental health settings, which are intensely expensive and very hard on a human being, and then sometimes onto the street itself. And so we really have to work together, as you see from the report, in terms of how do we coordinate the response, and so that folks don't have to, frankly, go back to jail or shelter. We really don't want to have to make people become homeless to access resources to get into recovery. I think that's an important and key point. And so certain kinds of housing, supportive housing at various levels, some folks just need a safe and decent place to live. And they need to have the kinds of supports, both rental, mental health, substance use treatment. And some folks may need, on the other side of the continuum, very significant levels of care. But the bottom line is, as we don't provide those things in this community and we just don't have enough of those, we will end up in this same cycle, which is very difficult for the human beings involved that are suffering with this. It's very expensive and it's not as effective. I just want to say, you know, we say over and over, the homeless system should be used as a crisis response system, a system in which when you've lost your housing, you come in, you stay a very short time, and we get you back on your feet. And the mental health component is important, an important part. Many of the things that have been pointed out in this report that we're looking to do will actually help end homelessness in our community, because it will prevent a great deal of people coming into shelter and cycling repeatedly.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Terry Russell, any sense about how, in numbers, that people can understand how many people are out there right now who are not being taken care of, who suffer from mental illness?
You know, those numbers are hard to come by, mm-hmm. but I will say this. We have 10 times more people with a severe mental illness in our prisons and jails in Ohio than we have in our state hospitals. I think that number itself is enough to say that we're not doing something. The shelters just said that we have 50% that have some kind of diagnosis of mental illness or addiction. Those numbers are staggering, and it's a tragedy in our society that we cannot come to grips with the need to treat these people, because treatment works. That's the other thing. If people get the appropriate treatment, they become productive citizens. The stigma around our illness says, you know, they're always going to be in need. That's not the case. And what we need to do is make sure that we understand that it costs $600, $700, $800 a day in a state hospital. How many people could we treat in the community and house people for that kind of money? And if we see those people in a private hospital or a psych hospital, a state-run hospital, they're only going to be there 10, 11, 12 days at the most, many 5, 6 days. And multiply that times the cost and see how long we could keep someone in the community in a house for that same amount of money and give them the treatment they need. So it's a tragedy. I really applaud the Franklin County Commissioners for this study from an outside group. But what we need now to do is change. Criminalizing the mentally ill is a travesty that needs to be changed.
Funds for mental health services, voters usually vote for them. They usually support them. Are they just not asking for enough?
Well, I think the local tax, and by the way, there's an initiative on the ballot this year in Frank County that we certainly need to support to keep the local system. I think we really need to talk about not only how much money, but where it's spent and who it's spent, who receives the services. Mm-hmm. That's a very difficult thing because everybody needs care and there are needs out there for everything. But the sickest of the sick, the promises when closing the hospitals must be fulfilled first. So let's take the money and relook at it. And by the way, this administration has just been incredible.
Yeah.
In the support of the people
the
that
Kasich
I represent.
The Kasich
administration, mm-hmm. the director of the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, everyone in that area.
Agreed.
The legislature, I don't believe, has kind of caught on by far 4 years ago, or 2 years ago, I'm sorry, when the biennial budget was passed. Mm-hmm. They did more for mental health than any time in my career. But now we see some cuts coming mm-hmm. again. So, you know, and I always say it was good because we were great advocates. No, it wasn't, because 26 kids got killed in Connecticut. Back then, the legislature knew they had to do something. How soon we forget. So it's now time for them to really look at the mental health system and the addiction system and say what needs to be provided and what's it going to cost.
We have an email from Carol. She writes, Franklin County has improved in the last few years. My sister was jailed about 10 years ago and had a very bad experience. More recently, another incident was handled by the police in a much different manner in which she was hospitalized rather than being arrested. I was very grateful. So Carol's sister was one of the lucky ones where they actually had some place to take her. They had an alternative, some kind of diversion. Michelle Heritage, when someone enters your system and you realize it's not going to work for you, what do you do? Do you call police? What mm-hmm. happens then?
Well, here's what we do. The first thing that happens when someone calls our homeless hotline and says, hey, I have no place else to go. I just need to come into shelter. They start with a series of assessments, asking them some very basic questions. When they arrive at the shelter, a whole nother assessment begins about what's happening with this person. Do they have symptoms that would indicate to us that they're suffering with a mental health challenge, or they have a substance use challenge as well? And then we begin to refer them. You know, 3 years ago, we began a planning process, and we're implementing right now to completely remake the homeless system. And that system is being enhanced with these new teams that our mental health board has funded very recently, and it's all coming together. We're actually right in the throes of it now. We also have a new system for navigators where a person, instead of being embedded with a provider and depending on what shelter you end up with, you get a new person every time that's working with you, the navigator stays with you. So if I come into the system and I have a mental health challenge and I am at one of the shelters, we're working on a plan, we're getting us linked. We might call the new teams in if I've, you know, had trouble linking in the past. And if I end up going to a different shelter, my navigator goes right there with me. And what I see in this report is this idea of a comprehensive type of system. And that's what we've tried to do in the homeless system and bring in other systems. And so if someone is demonstrating to us that they're not self-caring, that they have a real challenge, they're probably going to go to one of two places. We're going to call NetCare in for them to assess them to see if they need some sort of an inpatient hospitalization. And if they are publicly inebriated and not being able to self-care, they're going to end up at the Engagement Center, which is run by Mary Haven. Mm-hmm. And that's a place where we put in many, many years ago in partnership with Adam H. to stop jailing people who were publicly intoxicated, but instead, let's put them at a place where we can both help them get the services they need and help them get housed. The problem is there's not enough available in terms of someone who says, I want to get treatment. I want to get it right this minute. You have to intervene with that human being right then and there and get them the resources they need so that they can then get into recovery. And to Terry's point, folks get in recovery. Recovery happens. It's very fulfilling. And these will be folks that will then become taxpaying citizens and additive to the community.
If they come out of treatment and have a place to live, have food to eat, and Terry, you called it somebody who knows your name, and I think that's the piece, that navigator piece that you're talking about, Michelle Heritage.
That's exactly right. The fact is, if you think about, for us, for any human being, what would happen to your mental health state if you became homeless, it is very difficult for a person. You become depressed and anxious just because you're becoming homeless. Now, if you think about someone who may have some of those challenges to begin with, and then they're entering a homeless system, or they're entering a jail, or they're cycling back and forth between all these things, you're going to see someone who's going to continue to decompensate. And then we have an additional problem. We're just cycling down into a black hole. But what we know is if we can get folks the treatment they need and the housing stability they need, that's a key component, then they can get into recovery. We see this all over our community. We have about 1,200 units of supportive housing for folks that have disabling conditions, like we've been talking about, and have been long-term homeless. And the stick rate there is 95% after a year are still stably housed, and after 5 years, more than 70%.
1,200 units. How many are needed?
2,700 units minimally are needed. We're trying to bring on about 100 units every single year, and we do that with tax credits and support from the county commissioners, the city of Columbus. The shelter board raises funds from our private donors for that, but it's really deals that come together to bring these units on. And these are well-maintained, beautiful units. Most people don't know that are living maybe in the city of Bexley or Grandview or in German Village that these units are all around them. They're beautifully maintained, and it's a testament to the fact that when people get the support that they need and the care that they need, that they're productive citizens of our community.
I think responding to your email, she also probably received better police intervention, and you're going to talk about the crisis intervention teams later, but that has been a big thing here in Franklin County of training the police officers and the sheriff's department how to relate when they get a call. Unfortunately, the criminal justice system has become the quasi mental health system, and the first families don't know what to do at 3 o'clock in the morning when something is happening in their home, so they call the police. To have a police officer who's been trained to de-escalate the situation, to get that person in treatment instead of taking them to jail, has been probably the biggest breakthrough thus far in what we're trying to do. But we've got so much more to do.
And I agree. We you know, the police officers in this community, and we really have a pretty progressive law enforcement community in this community. They've even had folks, the shelter board on the regular goes out and trains police officers. What happens when you encounter someone on the street who's experiencing homelessness and appears to have a behavioral health challenge?
We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A recent study of the Franklin County criminal justice system by the Council of State Governments Justice Center found that people who are mentally ill are jailed more frequently and for longer periods of time. The pattern is destructive and expensive. The dynamic often begins on the street during that first encounter with law enforcement. Michael Woody is a retired Akron Police Department lieutenant. He also sat on the Ohio Supreme Court's Advisory Committee on Mentally Ill in the Courts from 2002 to 2011. He currently serves on the Attorney General Supreme Court of Ohio Task Force on Criminal Justice and Mental Illness, and he's president of Crisis Intervention Teams International. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be there on this show this morning.
Tell us what crisis intervention teams really means.
Well, I'm so glad that you said team, because a lot of times it's misconstrued that T in CIT stands for training, which is not true, although training is involved. Obviously, back in 1999, when I was the director of training for Akron Police, I went to Memphis, Tennessee, where they developed this crisis intervention team and went through the 40-hour course and came back a believer. And wow, this is a very enlightened way to police special officers for special people. Going forward, since 2000, when the first CIT course was taught on the Akron Police Department, to today, just about 8,000 Ohio police officers, most of them have volunteered to go through the course and become a CIT.
You said special officers for special people, but you never you don't necessarily know who you're going to come across in any given day. Is this the sort of training that every officer should have?
No. Okay. No, we recommend that, basically, because it's the same way of thinking about your SWAT teams. You know, not just any officer is well-suited to be a SWAT officer, and it's the same way with the crisis intervention team. The team really has two meanings, the team of officers who are patrol officers, because they're the first responders who volunteered for the course, and then the other part of the team is the partnership that you now have with, and it's a true partnership, with the mental health system in your county and also the advocacy groups in your county to troubleshoot any problems that may arise and to improve on things.
And it's improved things pretty quickly, right?
Yes, yes, it absolutely did. And the officers who feel that they're special, they love trying to handle these problems, which basically is de-escalating, using their mouth instead of their tools, if at all possible. And then there, you have your officers that do not like to handle those type of calls and really aren't suited. They don't use their words as well as others, and that's okay because everybody's different. But now they don't have to handle those calls, so they're happy.
There's the movie Silver Linings Playbook, and it focuses pretty directly on the relationship between the police officer and the family of the fellow who is suffering from mental illness in the film. And a lot of people have seen that movie but may not know what we're talking about when we say crisis intervention teams. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, yes, that really is. Compassionate officers that don't drop their safety issues. Matter of fact, the studies have shown that they're much, much safer because they de-escalate the situation and it doesn't escalate to where all of a sudden you have to use your tools or there's violence involved.
So when you went in 1999, when you were director of training for the Akron Police Department and you went to that training in Tennessee, what did it involve and how has it changed over the years?
Well, it hasn't changed much. Now,
okay.
They did tell us that it took them about 6 years to perfect that training, sort of a trial and error because it was something new. But back in 1999, they had perfected it. And, you know, this is the Memphis Police Department. They've been at it now for 27 years, and they haven't had a problem in those 27 years. I mean, it's worked wonderful for them, and it changed the entire culture of their entire police department, and all officers, whether they're CIT or not, have been safer and working a lot better. So it's basically teaching the officers what mental illness is all about and sort of why people with a mental illness may not be taking their medications because of the side effects or their unawareness that they have a mental illness. You bring in the person with a mental illness when they're having a good day because, in my opinion, officers don't have a realistic view of mental illness because we only get called when there's a crisis. So we're seeing this person at their worst.
Right.
So we're probably seeing their parents or their other loved ones who have called us at their worst. So we bring them in when they're having a good day, and it's a real eye-opener for the officers in the class. And what we're really trying to get at is to build empathy in the officers. Once they feel empathy, now they're much more willing and more accepting of the de-escalation techniques that come usually towards the end of the week. And then we practice them with professional, usually medical students or others, on role plays on the last day to practice the skills that they've learned. It works out great.
You know, I refer to that movie, Silver Linings Playbook, because it's very famous. It won a lot of awards. One of the factors, a couple big factors in that story was that he lived at home with his parents and he was very safe and secure, obviously well-fed. That's not the case often for people who are suffering from mental illness. They're often, as we've talked about earlier on the program, they don't have a place to go. They don't have a place to they don't know where they're going to eat next, and they don't have somebody who knows their name.
Yeah, and that's so often true, and what a sad commentary on the way in our country that we treat those with an illness. You know, unfortunately, it affects the brain, which can make you do strange things, and not only do you not get empathy, you don't even get sympathy at most of the time.
How much of a partner do you consider people like Michelle Heritage of the Community Shelter Board and the people that she works with? How much interaction is that part of the strategy as well, is to work with them?
Yes, it's crucial. You know, without those support systems, an officer is likely to take the person to jail. And most of the time they know that this is a sick person. But if your support system, your mental health system and others say, hey, we don't want them, or they make you jump through hoops, or they make you stay with that person for a long time when there's other calls that are mounting up, well, that sort of, you know, gets the officers thinking, well, you know what, maybe I should just skip trying to get them the help at this facility or that facility and put a small charge on them and take them to jail. CIT officers don't want to do that. That's the last thing they want to do.
Terry Russell from NAMI, Ohio, you're nodding your head throughout this whole thing. You've heard this before a million times.
Well, we're such a supporter of the CIT program. Matter of fact, we've received grants to support police officers to go to the training on a number of occasions. But families, again, we represent families and those living with the illness. We don't want them to get in confrontations because of their illness. We want to get them support when they need it at their worst moments. And the families are just so grateful for this program because sometimes they have to call the police because there's absolutely no other alternative in the community. We'd like to have a lot of alternatives they could call, but right now we don't have that. So they call the police come, and that can be a very difficult situation if the officer doesn't have the training to know what they're running into. And when they do, it really just changes the whole situation. And Lieutenant Woody has just been a tremendous asset to the state of Ohio.
Well, Michael Woody, how do you teach empathy?
Well, it's something that you have to see, and that's why in that 40-hour intensive course, we bring in all the right players when they're having a good day, and you'll see the change in the officers. It's like an eye-opener, and I think that's the reason that at the end of the course on the evaluations, most of the officers say it's the best course they've ever taken, and they wish they'd have known this a long time ago. And I know that kind of flies into the face of us saying, well, then why don't you put all officers through it? But you have to remember, in my county, Summit, in that 40-hour course, we have 8 medical doctors that come in. We have 4 or 5 PhDs and other instructors. Sometimes we have a total of 50 instructors who have all volunteered their time. It would cost you an arm and a leg if you had to pay for them, but because it's in their community, they feel it's worth it, and their agencies let them come in and teach. If you wanted to train all the officers, that would mean you'd have to have a CIT course run. Well, like in your county in Franklin, with you have about 4,000 officers, you'd have to be running that constantly, and that's a little bit too much to ask of our mental health system to run it that often. And again, the CIT officers love wearing that CIT pin. They feel special, and they should be special.
I have an email from Mickey who writes, one huge factor is that case managers, the people who know your name and link you to services, are severely overworked and underpaid. I know. I used to be one. They literally are not able to provide effective services to their impossible caseloads even when they get many unpaid hours, even when they work many unpaid hours. Then they get burned out. Getting a new case manager all the time does not help the clients either. Is that something that officers have to do? Well, you said, Michael Woody, that sometimes they don't have an alternative. There's no place to turn.
That's true. And, you know, in part of the CIT course, the officers, we call it a field trip day, and they'll ride with the case manager and visit their clients. And the officers come back, and it's, they always say the same thing. I said the same thing when I went to Memphis and I went out with a caseworker. Oh, my gosh, I can't believe the places they go in. They go into crack houses and everything, and usually they're alone and they have nothing to protect themselves. Thank goodness usually not much of anything happens to them, but it gives the officers a much, much greater appreciation for what they're doing. And it gets them so that if a caseworker ever did call for help, that they'd get there as quick as they could.
And I'd like to respond. That
Terry Russell,
that's
yeah.
a really point that I want to make very clear. Case managers are the single most important individuals, and I want all the case managers out there to hear this, within our system. And they are, in sometimes, they're entry level, younger people.
Because of the burnout problem.
Mm-hmm. and the turnover. But if you ask families that I represent, they will say a good case manager saves their lives. Mm-hmm. And I just can't overemphasize the need for our mental health system to recognize the need for good case managers.
And Michelle Heritage, I'm sure that's the same thing you experience.
Huge. I couldn't agree more. It is incredibly important. And having been a case manager in the behavioral health system and having run fleets and teams of case managers, you know, there were times on our case management teams where we'd have 125% turnover each year. It's a high caseload.
What does that even mean, 125%?
You're replacing virtually everybody once and some people twice in a one-year period. So you can imagine what this means for families and individuals that are trying to form relationships. And it is because the caseloads are very high. It's an entry-level type position many times. It's the work can be very arduous, as you heard, you know, folks going into settings. They're usually by themselves, and they may be driving, you know, all over town and going from place to place. I think one of the keys, and we've seen it work, and certainly our mental health board has recognized, is working in a team type of environment. You know, even as we put together our navigator system, which is really focused on getting people linked to the kinds of treatment and the kinds of things they need to end their homelessness, we have them in teams as well, so that you've got several people on a team that know and understand a person. They're able to work with them. They each bring different kinds of supports. So we may have a case manager that's highly educated and experienced working on a team with a person who has been homeless themselves, and so that we have peer-to-peer support working on the team with a person who is in charge of housing location, that knows the landlords and is specialized, and then another person on the team that is a workforce person. And those folks bring their specialties together and also support each other. And so I just so much agree with Terry that case management is the key. We've tried to build it out in the homeless system. And as I said, our system is really a crisis response system. Homelessness should be a very short experience in your life. If you ever do experience it, it should be for one time and one time only. And the keys to making that the reality in our community are to have the kinds of things that we've been talking about today in terms of the behavioral health services.
Michael Woody, you mentioned that CIT members wear a pin that signifies that they've had this special training, right?
That's correct. That way the consumers and their families know the officer that's showing up at the door knows what they're capable of. That works so much better for us in our community because we've trained the dispatchers on questions to ask over the phone, because that take a report call, if you do a little bit of digging, mm-hmm. you discover, oh, this is based in mental illness. I'll send the nearest CIT officer. And the families in our communities know this. So they're much quicker to call when their loved one is starting to escalate, because they're going to call the dispatcher, say, please send me a CIT officer. That's what they're going to get. So they know that things are going to go much better, so they don't wait till it escalates real high. And that's the beauty of having this team approach.
What is the expectation of the role of the CIT officer? The family, what are they expecting in that case? I know every case is different, but in general, they just want someone from the outside who understands the situation to help diffuse it? Is that what they're searching for?
Yes. Well, they know that CIT officer knows a lot about mental illness, and because these are usually repeat calls, they've probably been to that residence before, probably already built up a rapport with that person. They know what works and what doesn't work on the de-escalation techniques, and that's the beauty of the whole thing, the way it works.
For people who like measurements and like to do cost-benefit analysis, Michael Woody, can you give us a sense about what this saves taxpayers? Do you have a sense about what, when it comes to the bottom line, what it's doing by having things like crisis intervention teams?
Yeah, especially when you talk about diverting from jail, mm-hmm. it's in a ton of money to communities. And it's working out so much better. It's saving you in lawsuits. You know, it's saving you in a numerous amount of ways. And there are more and more studies coming out, especially since what's going on with policing in the last few months. I've been quite a popular guy on shows mm-hmm. like this, and going mm-hmm. to D.C. and talking with different people. De-escalation seems to be on the rise, and what most law enforcement is looking for doing often.
Well, thank you for sharing your time with us today, Michael Woody.
You're welcome.
Michael Woody, he's president of CIT International. That stands for Crisis Intervention Teams. Also, Michelle Heritage, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Michelle Heritage, executive director of the Community Shelter Board. And Terry Russell, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Ann.
Terry Russell, executive director for the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill in Ohio. Thanks to the Allside staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, and all the Allside's interns, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks again for listening. This is Allside's with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.